Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
Delivering all the news, the informed views, and just telling great motorsport stories since 2003. Powered by the racetalk.com. This is On the Grid.
Well, g'day everyone, and welcome to another episode of On the Grid here on mypodcasthouse.com or on the Radio Show Limited's RS1. Thank you for joining us. We're going to get straight into the program this week because we've got people all around the world. It's quite amazing. Over in the other part of Melbourne, to where I am, I think you're in the east, I'm very much in the west. We are poles apart. Mark Walker, hello to you.
There's virtually no delay between us talking to each other. It's fantastic. Technology is brilliant, Chebecki.
It is. It is amazing. And technology is great too because we can also chat to this man who joins us every week from a different state. This time he joins us from a different country. He's over in England, in the UK, in the old Dart, and his name's Richard Crail. G'day, Crailsy.
Hello, boys. This is odd. Usually it's a PM when we record this show. I know we're a day late this week, but that's international travel for you. But as I talk to you now, and we're recording this, so what is it, Wednesday night, I'm sitting at the headquarters of Haggerty Radio Le Mans, and I've just been delivered a cup of tea by the voice of sports car racing globally, John Hindhoff. So that's the life I'm living at the moment. How are you?
No, we're okay. I think, yeah, we're doing okay. Not obviously not as highfalutin as you, but...
Well, you know, Shebeck, someone has to do it. No, look, I'm in the UK, and as you listen to this episode when it goes live, we'll be, I imagine, somewhere under the channel on our way to France for the Centenary Le Mans 24 Hour, which is next week, but we roll into testing and pre-event stuff this week. So, yeah, really cool. It's a long way to get here. You forget the whole international travel thing, which we were sort of black banned from for some time.
You did it with no stops from Australia, didn't you?
I did, yes, yes. Stay tuned for the power rankings. There'll be more commentary on
international travel. Hot or not, stay tuned.
I'm not going to spoil that. Let's not give that away too early in the program, shall we?
What is unusual is normally when someone's broadcasting from overseas, it's normally two of us. We haven't done too many solo overseas chats.
No, you're right. True. You and I did the Indianapolis 500. Yeah. Mark and I did Daytona.
Correct.
I don't recall that still.
You and I have done New
Zealand.
We did
that Tassie one once. Yeah, we did New Zealand. That's right. Yeah. You got fobbed off by Shane Van Gisbergen. So highlights everywhere.
Exactly.
But no, it's very cool to be back over here, by the way. And it's such a motor racing place. And yeah, really exciting. So it's going to be an exciting couple of weeks. And hopefully we'll be able to convey some of that to you, the listener, via On the Grid, but also Midweek Motorsport on the Radio Show Limited network of channels. And then, of course, Haggerty Radio Le Mans, which basically burst into life from this week, essentially. And there's going to be an amazing amount of coverage coming from the race. So please make sure you tune in.
Exactly. Hey, now, will I be right in saying that you've done two legs of the Triple Crown? And I want to know what your version of the Triple Crown is for motor racing. But mine would be Indianapolis 500, Le Mans 24 Hour, and Monaco. For me, that would be the Triple Crown of motor racing. Would I be right?
Well, that is the Triple Crown of... That's what McLaren was celebrating last week. So actually, you have actually just named the Triple Crown.
There you go. They should. Yeah. It's
the iconic Triple Crown. I have no burning desire to go to the Monaco Grand Prix. I know that might sound strange, but there are other Grand Prix on the list I'd rather go to first than that. I'd probably rather go to Spa before I went to Monaco. But but that's just me. But from a endurance racing point of view, this is the granddaddy, isn't it? And from a major headline, well-known household name motor race, I mean, Indy 500, Daytona 500, Le Mans 24 Hour, you know, Bathurst 1000, you know, very fortunate to get those opportunities to go to them. Somehow, Mark, I've ticked off the milestones. I don't know how.
Yeah, I think you're all having an absolute cop out there. It's clearly the Bathurst 6 hour, Bathurst 12 hour, and Bathurst 1000. And when they had the Bathurst 500, that was a really good year.
Fair.
Yeah, no, I'm hearing you. Well, is the Daytona 500 like the Players Championship in golf, which is like the fourth or fifth major, or whatever they say?
What does I don't understand the reference to golf.
Well, no, I'm just saying because it's outside the Triple Crown, it's outside those majors, but it is as prestigious, I would suppose.
It's a major. It's definitely. Mark would agree that the Daytona 500 is definitely a major.
It's like Bathurst 1000 is a major. It's up there.
Yeah, exactly. Before we have a look forward and tell us what will be happening this weekend over at Le Mans, let's have a look back to what was a pretty exciting weekend, as always, when we have a Monaco and a Indianapolis 500 weekend basically together. Let's kick off with the Formula One first. Can I go with an early hot?
Yeah, sure.
Rain at Monaco. Because seriously, if we didn't have rain at Monaco, we would have had probably one of the all-time most boring races of all time. Verstappen would have won by 25 minutes.
That's a big call because that place has churned up some pretty average car races over the last few years. Look, it definitely helped spice the race up, didn't it? And if it didn't overtly change the result, at least it gave us some excitement and it gave us some moments. There were some great onboards and some amazing car control from those drivers, which is great, which showcases just the old adage that you need to pull the grip out of these things and they become so spectacular. It teased and teased and teased, and then it finally rained. But it was just unfortunate that it didn't quite affect the result so much that it gave people an opportunity to gamble with a strategy or a tie call that could have jumbled the results order up. Much was made of Aston Martin, going to a slick again and then pitting again to put the Inter on, but ultimately it didn't change the result because A, Max was so far in front, but B, everyone else had to do exactly the same thing. And it's just the way that the sport's going at the moment that that Max is just so, everything's coming up Milhouse for him that they pitted late enough to only do one stop and make that call to go to the Inter rather than have to put slicks on and then come back in again. It's just everything, when you're in that kind of imperious form, everything works for you, even to the point the weather plays the game for you. So you only have to make the one pit stop, and as a result, he was never going to be beaten.
But that was a part of their plan. That's why their plan was all along. They knew that weather was a really big chance, and when it was an apparent chance, they didn't do the Aston Martin and dive in for the mediums. two laps later, turn around and give Max a 27-second victory. I suppose the big loser of the weekend, Sergio Perez, he had an absolute Barry. Then this is dipping into my hot. So they put his car on a crane. So everyone had a really good look at what's underneath the Red Bull, their secret sauce. So that was interesting, wasn't it?
It was the same with Lewis when he stopped earlier in the weekend and Toto had a bit of a shot at the fact that everyone got a really good look at the underside of the Mercedes. But then the point is that why would anyone want to look underside that car, which isn't particularly competitive? So who cares?
Yes, I had a similar situation at Tasmania when we took the Formula Ford drivers into the DJR garage. And when I was taking photos, I was told just to be selective in what I took photos of. And I thought exactly the same thing. Why would anyone sort of want to know anything at the moment?
Who did that? Because it's not like they're designing their own uprights anymore or anything like that.
I know.
They're literally the same car team to team. So why should they be protective of what Cody?
Just telling you what was said to me. Could you please just be careful what you take photos of, because we don't want to give any IP away.
Should focus on going faster. But anyway.
Fernando Alonso just keeps on racking them up. Podiums, he's just doing a great job this year, isn't he?
He's going to win at some point, surely.
You would hope so.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous. Like 5 podiums out of 6 races.
Yeah.
Like, who had that in the bingo card?
Yeah.
No.
And it's
I wasn't allowed to make bingo cards.
No, and rightly so.
No, we absolutely black banned that. there's a backstory behind that, folks. We'll explain one day. It's the story of the season so far, is Aston Martin.
Yeah.
And with what they're building and what they're doing. You could only anticipate that unless they do something particularly crazy, it's going to continue because they've got this massive new factory being built down at Silverstone. They're going to have their own wind tunnel online in 18 months. They're going to become completely self-sufficient, and now they've done a deal to be the works Honda team. And it took Honda a couple of goes, but the last time they were in as a manufacturer, they gave Red Bull the power plants to do what they're doing now, so which is essentially still a Honda engine. So, gee, they're ticking a lot of boxes. It's what happens when you get a billionaire buy your race car team. You can actually get yourself some success. So it's a ripper story. And for Fernando in his 40s to be continually doing this, it's tremendous. And can you imagine if he goes and wins the Spanish Grand Prix this weekend?
Oh,
the Mardi Gras will never stop. It'd be insane.
Yeah.
Be like being at Sandfoot. Third, Alpine. They found a circuit where they came good. Just unfortunate that every other circuit on the calendar is nothing like Monaco. So sorry about that. You tried your best. You got one good result, but we're back to business as normal from here on in. But Ocon there, his third career podium, and he looked pretty happy about it.
And Mercedes is pretty much where they're at. Do we expect that they're going to get better, or is that Mercedes for this year?
You think they'll get better, but they bought all their upgrades to that race, but it's not. That's not a racetrack where you learn if your massive aero upgrade is going to be effective or not. So they were competitive-ish, but they were no better or worse than they were. And we'll find out. Barcelona, you know, the circuit where everyone's done a trillion miles of testing is going to be the circuit where they work out, you know, where their car's at, where this Evo 2 AMG basically is where it's at. So hopefully they take a step forward, because we need somebody else in the fight to try and stop Verstappen out in front.
The other one that sort of impressed me was Aussie Oscar. He made a few moves there and was back in the points. So and he's one spot behind Lando, which is absolutely all you could ask and expect of him. Like, especially after Norris pantsed Ricciardo those last couple of years, Oscar's doing all the right things so far.
Yeah, it was a really promising drive, and at one point got in front, but ultimately finished just behind, but world championship points at Monaco, and McLaren, that's still not particularly competitive, was a really good drive. And in those situations, all he's got is his teammate. So if you can match Lando Norris, who's very highly rated, then big tick.
You talk about Aston Martin and their massive improvement this year. It's all been from one car, though, hasn't it? They haven't had much from the son of. Does Dad need to have a conversation there at some point? Is that something that could become difficult at some point?
Does he have to?
Well, you don't want to just be running around with one serious car.
Only one car is going to win the world championship, though. Drivers, that is. So,
I mean, Lance did clatter into everything there on the weekend. He was the only retirement from the race. Yeah.
Stroll's one of those drivers that, like, on his day, he's quick enough to be, you know, a regular points contender and a podium finisher perhaps, but unlikely he's going to be world champion, especially in a team while Fernando's there. But, I suppose it's how long Dad wants to keep bankrolling his boy going car racing. And then if Lance isn't there, what does Lawrence do? Does he keep funding it? And the answer to that is, honestly, is probably yes, because the way that Formula One is going now, the franchises that they are now worth much, much more than probably what anyone paid for them. Mm. So it's an asset that's only appreciating, especially with the investment they're making in it.
And the sponsors they've got on board too.
Yeah.
Parlaying it there.
Yeah, Spanish Grand Prix this week. Look forward to it coming up over the weekend. Indy 500.
Before we go on to Indianapolis, the Spanish Grand Prix at Catalunya is always rubbish. It's not a great Formula One track, can we just say? And they've got rid of that dinky die chicane at the final corner, finally, which is great. So hopefully these new cars produce good racing there, because Catalunya in the past has been as catatonic as Monaco has without the yachts and the harbour and the super scenics. So fingers crossed that it actually produces a Grand Prix. But anyway, on to Indianapolis.
An exciting version of it.
When is it not?
No, well, that's true. That's a very good point.
It's a mad car.
But to go right up to the very, well, once again, when hasn't it gone up to the very last lap? It generally does, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, it was insane and brutal and controversial and dramatic. And scary. But in the end, you know, positives first, Nygaard breaking through. It was the one on his CV that he didn't have. 12 starts, no wins, one of the best IndyCar drivers. And for IndyCar racing in America, so important to have a fast young American driver. And that's what they've got. And Newgarden's such a good ambassador for the sport. It was great to see him succeed. And I think Aussie and fans from our part of the world have probably had a better appreciation for Newgarden since the whole McLaughlin thing and the Bus Bros and everything they're doing, because I think Newgarden before that came across as being, you know, a very buttoned down, straight down the line, you know, engaging, but fairly sort of, I don't know what the right word is. Is
Penske material.
The right word? It was a Penske driver, exactly right. But so he was great, but nothing you'd ever go, oh, that bloke's a legend, or oh, that bloke's a moron. It was just straight
just
down
do
the
what
line.
He had to do.
But yeah, but now he's opened himself up and he's got this great personality. He's very funny. He and the little byplay he and McLaughlin have got are brilliant. And I think he's endeared himself to fans more than he could have by winning bulk IndyCar races. Interesting to note that he's won the last 5 oval races in IndyCar racing. So he's very, very good on the speedways. But the scary thing is he's brilliant on the road courses as well. So, really cool to see him get that win. Amazing for Penske to win his 19th 500. I read a story online that Roger's parking space at IMS out the back of the big pagoda there has been number 18 since their last win. And apparently, and this story goes, I read it on the internet, so, you know, believe what you may, but the story goes is that by the time everyone was leaving the speedway on the Sunday night, his parking space number had been changed to number 19.
True story.
Just great. That is so good.
The thing with the Newgarden win that I really appreciated was the celebration. Like, you don't see much innovation in celebration these days, do you? But picking out that photographer's hole, and it wasn't really a hole. It was a bit of a glitch in the matrix there that he was able to slip through and then try and dash up to the back of the grandstand, and he got to about row 3 and got mobbed. I thought that was awesome. And NBC did a mega job.
Yeah.
Just letting all the natural sounds play out there. That was really cool.
Yeah, the difference between that and Monaco was shocking in that, you know, Monaco, you've got those orange-suited officials fencing off the Parc Fermé guys. Mm. You know, what you want at Monaco is to park the car at the swimming pool chicane, jump over the fence and dive into the harbour and go and jump on the back of a super yacht and celebrate like that. Like, that would be the Monaco equivalent of
and
what...
That's where the donuts are. Yeah. Sick.
Yeah. And, it's one of the great celebrations. And I think that could become like the Castroneves fence climb. That could be the new version of that people imitate. And it was interesting that Blaney did that at Charlotte at the NASCAR race. He did the same thing. And he said, because I saw Scotty do it, I wanted to do the same thing. So Newgarden do it, I wanted to do the same thing. So, it was brilliant. That was so good. And you're right, Mark, the way that NBC treated it was outstanding, and that deserved silence, and that it made the images even stronger, I thought.
Record prize money too for that race. Amazing when you look at the dollars that were up for grabs. $17 million US in prize money. Newgarden walks away with $3.66 million, which is what? Nearly $6 million Australian, just over $6 million Australian?
Guarantee you there'd only be... It'd only be one car in that field that made a profit all month.
Yes, it'd be that one. Yeah. Well, $1 million, Ericsson, $1 million was second, which is a decent runner-up prize, given he won it last year. And Ferrucci did a right.
Scotty, your hot tip, Scotty, 14th with $485,000. So not
still
bad.
Not a terrible day at the office, isn't it? That'd be more than he would have ever made in a supercar season, wouldn't it? You reckon? As a base wage? He would have been
485 is just say, let's say 750, 800.
Yeah. So, yeah, he probably would have been on
American dollars.
No, 800 Australian. So, he probably would have just... Oh, we'd have been over a mil, wouldn't he, towards the end?
Yeah, you're probably right.
Before he left.
Still, it's a pretty nice race account,
but that's a season, though.
Well, yeah, regardless, he probably made more in one race in terms of earned more in one race in prize money. Bear in mind, the team will get half of that at least. But he probably did better out of that than half the supercar field gets paid for a full year. So
it's going to be the biggest paying race in the world, isn't it? No other prize money.
I think it still is, yeah. Yep. And so they should, because 330,000 was the estimated crowd on Sunday, and the Speedway did say it's the second biggest attendance in the last 15 years, so the biggest being the 100th in 2016. But the most important thing, I think, to take out of that week, and from many people I've spoken to that were there, that the whole month of May, it's a fortnight now, crowds were all up. So they announced 90,000 for qualifying weekend for Saturday and Sunday for pole day and bump day. And then carb day, our friend of the show, Matt Nolte, was at carb day. And he said it was 100,000 people there on carb day on the Friday for the IndyCar practice. And then a Bryan Adams concert, which he said apparently was outstanding. So they're rebuilding that month gradually to be more than just the one day, the race day, to be a massive feature, which is really, really cool. So that's why they can afford to bump the prize money up to $17 million for the full field, which is excellent.
Richard, question for you without notice. Three red flags at the finish there. It had a lot of Australian Grand Prix about it, but I've got to say that race, watching it later, when you know that everyone survived and walked away and it was happy and awesome, 100 out of 10. But watching it live, holy moly, that's scary. That is just, it's such a terrifying thing, having those guys, have a green-white checker out there on cold tires and not lifting, and we don't care, we're going for the win.
White checker is what I'm saying. It wasn't green white.
True.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I watched it live and it was pretty compelling. Give you the hot tip, good or bad. You didn't watch away. For sure. 100%.
Thoughts on the loose wheel?
They dodged a bullet there for sure. And that's such a rare thing these days. And you need to give... You do need to give credit to that in some respect, because that now has become such a rarity in the sport, especially in oval racing, that it just doesn't happen anymore, or very, very rarely. So for that to happen, was extremely rare and showed you how violent that crash was. And then B, the side effect was that the only damage out of it was a 10-year-old Chevy Cruze, and it's probably no great loss that there's one less of them in the world anyway. So The sport 100% dodged a bullet, though. Totally. If that had ended up in the grandstand, it would be a very, very different narrative. Very, very different narrative. And they'll go through all the various permutations and why the wheel tether didn't work. But sometimes, this is open wheel racing, that sometimes you have a crash big enough where the wheel tethers don't work. They're designed for an enormous amount of shearing stress, but sometimes they're just not good enough, and clearly that was the case.
I'm going to dip into my knots here, but I got out the tape measure on Google Maps, and there's nearly 3.2 k's of continuous grandstand around that track. You think about the maths about that, MCG, there's 450 meters of continuous grandstand around the G, and here's 3.2 k's of grandstand. It's just ridiculous, and there's literally two gaps, decent sort of natural gaps in that grandstand. One is the grandstand at Turn 3 that Tony Arena wound up in and unfortunately died in 2003, and they took that grandstand away a few years later. And second is this gap between the corporate suite and that last grandstand down there at Turn 2, which is 40 metres long. Mm. And this tyre has picked that gap and then landed on this shitbox. Motorsport is so kissed. Like, that's the thing that is going to ruin motorsport, is sending a car into a crowd or doing something awful like that. We've already got enough problems with insurance, like even here locally in Australia. You look at what's happening in Targa and Fink and these sort of things, where it's relatively small contained issues that they've got. But, you know, you do that at a thing that has 350,000 people, you don't want to see stuff heading towards the grandstand. So they got away with one there. But the genuine question, yeah.
The sport is good in learning from stuff like that.
Well, they have to, yeah.
If there's a positive about it is that, and IndyCar especially have been outstanding in fixing this kind of stuff over the years. So they'll go through and understand what's going on and analyze it. And I mean, the bloke who owns the series also happens to own the racetrack. So from a series point of view, they'll analyze that and the racetrack will also change. But like Shebex, you and I were there in 16. Yep. I don't know if we've ever mentioned that on the show that we went to the 100th running, but, Mark Walker has left the chat. That's awkward. But that place, not once did I ever sit there and go, gee, I'm worried about catching a wheel. Like it feels, and look, it might be a false bravado, but the catch fencing there is as high as anything.
As high as anything, 100%.
Anything I've ever seen, yeah. For sure. Like there are prisons with fences lower than that. But all they can do is learn and understand and work out. Thank you very much, John Hodnoff. He's just bought me a second cup of tea as we work into the second half of this. Haggerty Radio coming back is superb.
You're not coming back.
So my one question from that whole tire episode is, how does a dirty old 10-year-old Chevy Cruze get the best car park at the racetrack? The
premium car park, yeah, between the back of the turn two suites and the Brickyard Crossing golf course. How do you end up parking in there? That is outstanding. Good car park.
There'll be an empty space there next year, but yeah, whatever.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I loved, to be fair, and the way they reacted to it was great. And Doug Bowles invited that lady who apparently was working in those suites, and her friends, you know, invited her into the circuit after the race and got her onto the start-finish line and a photo on the bricks and all the behind-the-scenes access. So that really classy way they manage that. I thought that was really nice. It's really good.
The funny thing would be is if that car was actually illegally parked in that spot,
that'd be
and the Nick goes and cops that, that would just...
In some cities you get towed, but in Indianapolis, in Speedway, Indiana, you get a Firestone thrown at you at 230 miles per hour. But what a show, though.
It is a good show.
And just the drama. I'm interested in thoughts on in the whole weaving thing. Like that Newgarden, and look, you're doing it to win one of the biggest races in the world. You drive the thing into pit wall if you have to, if it means you win it. But my God, that was pretty testy, you know, going basically into pit entry. I don't know. I kind of like to see that line be out of bounds on restarts or something like that, because that was pretty hectic. Pretty hectic. Yeah. Because you could have a big crash and then you could crash into the attenuator at the end of pit lane. And that's more than a big crash. So,
yep.
But everyone got out of it.
And ultimately, though, it was unbelievable. So from a drama point of view, but people will talk about that race for a long, long time. And that's why 300,000 people keep going back.
Well,
amazing.
Will they be talking about the Le Mans 24-hour 100th version? For a very, very long time, Richard. Tell us about what's coming up this weekend.
Well, I got a feeling I will be, but that's just me. It's going to be enormous. This race has been sold out for months, and we're talking 250,000 people. And as opposed to Indy, which is one day, this is for a long period of time, so basically for the whole event. So that's going to be something to behold that this race hasn't seen before. And then there's just it's the most competitive outright field the race has seen in years. So genuine competition for Toyota, Porsche back with Roger Penske in an outright level, Cadillac's there, you know, Ferrari back at Le Mans in an outright capacity with their new car, which has proven pretty competitive in the opening couple of rounds of WEC. The list goes on and on and on. LMP2 looks like it's going to be an absolute war zone because that field is remarkable. And then it's the last event for the current GT formula, the GTE cars who get phased out for GT3 cars next year. And that's a story on its own. So, yeah, there's so many underlying storylines about how this race will play out. The NASCAR, how good's that? I'm super excited to see that thing run and how that plays out. And the Camaro run by Hendrick Motorsport and Chevy, GM heavily involved, Jimmy Johnson, you know, Chad Knaus behind the scenes helping drive it. They've got some amazing firepower there. World champion in Jensen Button and Mike Rockefeller is one of the best sports car racers steering that thing. The list and list and list goes on, but what I'm most looking for is the feeling. Like you guys know what it's like when you go to these events, and especially events with the kind of history and reverence that these events have, that you really only get that when you're there. TV, or in my instance this week, radio, can only convey so much, and we try and convey it as well as we can, but you know, watching the start of the Indy 500 on TV is incredible, but it's not even 20% of what it's like when you're there. And I can only imagine that it's going to be the same this or next week for the centenary Le Mans 24 Hour. To get to the point, we're in the UK, we head to France, and then Friday, Saturday, a scrutineering day. So famously, all the cars go into Le Mans itself. They're checked over. It's a massive fan event. They get their tick of the box to be allowed to go racing, and then Sunday is the unopened test day, basically the pre-event Le Mans test for a day. So that'll be the first real indicator of who's where in terms of outright speed, and probably not a massively accurate form guy, but we'll get a decent idea, and teams will work through their programs with fuel economy and tyre and work out what tyre life is. And that's been a big talking point as well with the tyre warmer stuff that's been going on in WEC. Monday, Tuesday, quiet days, and I'm looking forward to going and checking out the Le Mans Museum. Sorry, Mark, I'll take lots of photos, don't worry, where they've got a massive centenary exhibition on. And then from Wednesday, they're on track. Away we go. And it builds up to the race start Saturday night, Australian time, at midnight, and then predictably it runs for 24 hours.
And the best thing about it is... we're gonna win. Is that, especially if you're here in Melbourne, King's birthday public holiday on the Monday.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So you can watch the full 24 hours and then just, chill on the Monday.
Oh, yeah. But I just can't stand these time certain races, Richard. I'm just over it.
Is it 24 hours plus one lap?
No, it's damn. Not. The clock stops and then the checkered flag comes out the next time the winner comes by. So it's exciting. It's hugely exciting. It's going to be great. And there's so much going on in and around it, and so many storylines. So it's hard to cover them off. And Hindhoff will join us on the show next week for a big preview. I'll be on Midweek Motorsport Thursday morning Australian time. So will that be after this goes out? Probably will be, won't it? So. You've just heard me on Midweek Motorsport on RSL. So check that out. And then Hindy will jump on the show and I'll try and grab some stuff from test day and the preparations for next week's On the Grid, which we'll do a big preview on. But it's exciting. Can't wait.
If there's any towels hanging around, Richard, just make sure you grab a couple.
Yeah, I don't think Pennzoil, it's another story that sort of no one will know what we're talking about, but the few of us that understand the Pennzoil towel story from Indianapolis will get it and have a...
The good thing is we can do the bingo, we can tell the bingo story in a couple of weeks just before Darwin, in the preview to Darwin.
Mm-hmm. So, I like it.
We'll definitely do that. All right, looking forward to a massive preview next week of Le Mans and what's going to be happening there on the weekend. Hots and knots, gentlemen. Richard, yes, you kick us off.
Okay, thank you. What are we starting with, knots or hots?
Hots. Let's start with hots.
Hots. The John Wick franchise is my hot. For some reason, I hadn't seen them. I don't know why.
Oh, really?
I love action movies. I love Keanu Reeves. Brilliant actor. Don't know why I'd never watched them. So I watched the first three on the flight over, and the new one that's just come out, I'm going to watch on the way back. Just great.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed that. That's a hot. Qantas, get a big hot from me. Thank you for flying direct from Australia to the UK. None of this changing planes rubbish halfway through. Really good service. And yes, I was in cattle class, but it was fine. Another sideline hot to that is that you get into Heathrow at quarter to five in the morning. It's deserted. Never seen the place so quiet. So I was out of Heathrow, like wheels down to out waiting for my Uber, and that will be my next hot, in like 20 minutes. It's extraordinary. It's
not a world that's better than Adelaide Airport. That beats your Adelaide Airport record.
It's bloody close, Shebex. I'll give you the hot tip. Next, my Uber. So I was picked up from Heathrow by the voice of sports car racing, John Hindhoff.
Oh, that's all right.
In his very nice 992 Porsche GDS with the 7-speed manual. And that was tremendous. Very, very good. 5 stars for that Uber service, I've got to say. It's the best I've ever had. But then what happened was, as part of that, Mark.
So what was the surge on that? Part one of my question. And part two is, where did you fit your bag?
Well, it's a Porsche 911, which is the practical supercar, Mark. So my bag and my backpack fit in the front, the front trunk in the 911. It slid straight in. No problems whatsoever. Just outstanding. No surge pricing at that time in the morning when it had a lovely full English, because it was 6 a.m. in the morning. And then also hot is a remarkable place called Bicester Heritage. Now, Bicester Heritage is at a former World War II RAF base. It was where the Bristol Blenheims were based, the bombers that would go over and bomb Europe, basically, during World War II. And it's been turned into, it's still an active airfield, but it's been turned into this massive innovation precinct for British motoring and motorsport. McLaren's Extreme E team is based there. There's a whole heap of classic car restoration businesses. There's an amazing place filled with old Bentleys. Really cool, amazing place filled with heritage from World War II. So I ticked a lot of boxes and the things I love. So that's a massive hot for mine. And just wrapping it up, I can't get over how cool it is to have an Aussie calling the Indy 500. And Lee Diffie's call of that race was spectacular in between the NBC ad breaks. So well done to Diff, and that's a massive hot for me.
Yeah. I just added an extra hot. I'm going on holidays to Germany in September, and I think I might just go and sit at the Nürburgring for 2 weeks and just mail that in. See how you're going. Yeah, righto, mate. We all got stuff going on. the Coca-Cola World 600. I'm going to notch that up as a hot. Very long race. Very, very long race. 4 hours 59 minutes. 15 minutes shy of the all-time record long race. Sure. So that was. But there was plenty happening. They even had a mid-race rain break. The whole race was rain delayed by a day. Mid-race rain break there where Eric Almirola and Bubba Wallace managed to have a fight. So that was nice. And then not long after that, Denny Hamlin got hooked by Chase Elliott and has subsequently been parked for a week. NASCAR's most popular driver benched for a week. Could you imagine if they bench Craig Lowndes? I don't know who the most popular driver is anymore in supercars.
Oh, it's still Craig Lowndes.
It's still bench Craig Lowndes.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
But that's a really big thing over there. So, Chase missed 6 weeks with a broken leg from his snowboarding, and now he's going to effectively rule himself out of last week when he shunted, and he's going to miss next week. He's going to be replaced by Corey LaJoie in the 9, which is pretty cool that he's being put up into the big leagues. So that's cool. So hot to that. That was all good. I'll give a hot to the Matty Mingay documentary, Challenge Accepted. It's now on his YouTube and it's for free now. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's a really amazing look behind the scenes of that awful shunt that he had over there in the Detroit and in the jumpy trucks back in 2016. And I was reasonably familiar with what went on. We put on a bit of a fundraiser for him when he got back and sort of knew what went on there. But this documentary is warts and all. It is incredible stuff. Like, go and watch it. The documentary's hot. The construction of the Detroit street circuit is an absolute knot. I'm not going to give away what happens in the doco, but it is disgusting. Like, a professional racetrack, the way that they built it, that was not good. So go and check that out for yourself. From the F1 side of things, side pods, so hot right now. Like all the cars have them. It's just a really hot new innovation that they're working on. So congratulations to Mercedes. And also to the TV coverage. We mentioned NBC from in IndyCar, the TV coverage from Monaco, where they've told the local nuff-nuffs to pack their bags, and they got the regular people in there. Things like the helicopter, so new angles. It was amazing. Well directed. Not cutting away from a Lance Stroll crash. You know? There were plenty of them, so they had a chance. So that was hot. And my final hot, you know, everyone loves motorsport for their own reasons. And, you know, I sort of think about it a bit over time why I like it. And I'm here for the people. I love the business of motorsport. I love any machine that's well driven. Like, I always respect that. And I love good racing. And if you too love good racing, you would have loved Phillip Island State Championships on the weekend. That was really, really entertaining stuff. Especially, even if some of the races, you know, the leader buggers off into the distance, down the pack, some of the stuff that went on was just amazing. The Toyota 86 Scholarship Series was there, and they were ludicrous. Like, I've seen some Toyota 86 races in my time, but this was just next-level stuff, and they all raced really well, even with relatively inexperienced competitors behind the wheel. So that was really good. I just had the best day on Saturday with my kid down there. We just have the best time at these race meetings. Got to 3 o'clock. He was getting a bit grumpy. Fell straight asleep. Woke up 40 minutes later, picked his nose, went back to sleep for another 20 minutes. So definitely my son. No denying that. And we just had the best day out. And if you like motorsport, go and check out some state-level stuff. I know there's a big state round at the Bend over the weekend, and that looked like it was pretty well attended as well. Some really good high-end stuff went on there. So
I think the good thing about that too is that there was a historic round at Winton that had a good crowd as well. So motorsport was really thriving on the weekend.
I think there's one at Sydney Motorsport Park too. So plenty going on.
New South Wales State.
Yeah, beautiful.
Hot.
My hot, and I gave one earlier, obviously, rain at Monaco. That was a hot for me. But as I was just doing a little bit of research for the Le Mans 24-hour, I've scrapped every other hot, because I've seen my one and only hot that I need for this week. And it is the Team Project One Porsche 911, the car driven by PJ Hyatt, Gunnar Genetti, and Matteo Caroli. And it's a T-Rex. It's a green Tyrannosaurus Rex car. It is the most amazing-looking car I've ever seen. And from doing a bit of research into it, apparently PJ Hyatt's kids drew the design. Which is quite amazing. Cop this car if you can, folks. It's in the it's on the website for the Le Mans 24-hour. It's the 56 car. But it actually is just a bloody good-looking car.
Well, my kid's over here picking his nose. Like, well, should I have him drawing race cars instead?
Well, yes.
It's good, isn't it? So that car, it's brilliant. So that car's been running, well, that livery has been running with AO Racing in IMSA competition this year.
Okay.
So PJ runs the T-Rex and a unicorn on his race helmet, which is like him taking his family with him when he goes racing.
How good.
But the car, it's become quite iconic, hasn't it?
The Rexy livery, they call it.
Yeah. Gunnar Jeanette, who's been at Le Mans for a long time, has been the team manager there as well. So they've got some great Le Mans context. But it's a cool livery, and
it uses the Porsche lights as the eyes. It's got the nose at the bottom of the bonnet, the massive. I'm not going to give it away. Check it out, because you're going to see this car. This is a very, very hot looking car.
Yeah, no, it's hot. There's no doubt. Correct. Well said.
Knots.
England is too far away from Australia. Imagine if
this is another one of our geography lessons here, Peyton, on the grid geography lessons.
I love New Zealand, don't get me wrong, and I love New Zealanders, and hello to our New Zealand audience. But can you imagine how unbelievably good if we lived in Australia, right, with everything that's amazing about Australia, but right next door was the UK, so you could just pop over and go to Silverstone or wherever. Yeah, it's a long flight. For 16 hours and 45 minutes is a bit outrageous. So, yeah, that's definitely a knot, but you can't
that's
change
a short
that. So
flight,
there you go.
Considering you could have been stopped at Dubai for 4 hours.
Well, and that's why you fly direct in Qantas. Yeah. That's why I put that in the hot. Not English weather. We got in and I had been primed and told by our English representatives that the day of my arrival was potentially going to be the warmest day, May day, in like, if not ever, a long, long time. It was like mid to low 20s, which is just cute. But that was the theory. So I was all set. I had the shorts packed, ready to go. It's not. It's cold and rainy, which is exactly what I left in Adelaide to come over here. So France is looking better. So an early not for English weather and a preemptive hot for literally and metaphorically for France's weather next week. In opposition to Mark's hot, the Coke 600 is too long.
Nah.
It's worse when it's preceded by the Xfinity Series. That's too much of a good thing in a day. It's too much NASCAR.
No, it was preceded. Then they got rained out. Then they put the Xfinity Series on afterwards because they had to cram that into that day because they're racing in Portland this week, which is 52 hours away.
Literally the other side of the country. Too much NASCAR in a day. That's
so Xfinity must have finished at 1 in the morning or something, did it?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Awful. Correct. But it was at home. It was a home race, so whatever.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Yeah. A massive knot. I couldn't help but notice, Mark, that for all of the celebrities at the Monaco Grand Prix, and there were celebrities there, no Tay-Tay, no Taylor Swift.
Yeah, she's got a tour, mate. On the weekend, she's running a tour.
But it's the Monaco Grand Prix. If you are anyone and anywhere, you are at the Monaco Grand Prix, especially if you're dating Fernando Alonso. So. I'm sorry.
She's out there earning billions of dollars on the Eras Tour, that whatever it is, and she's just needs that money to play cards with Mr. Stroll, the team owner. Mm-hmm. So she's got enough money to play cards.
Yeah, it's all right. Don't worry, Richard. Everything's fine there. Everything's
wait till Las Vegas.
To not.
Mark?
That's my not.
I'll start out with a what. This week, IndyCar's going off to Detroit and they moved the race from Belle Isle to this pokey-looking 90-degree cornered street circuit in downtown Detroit. And they've designed a racetrack, you beauty, except then they forgot that they were supposed to put a pit lane in. And then they couldn't put the pit lane in because there wasn't enough space for a pit lane. So what they're going to do is innovate. And, you know, a week after the Indy 500 where everyone crashed in the perfectly straight, nice, long pit lane, they're going to have a double-sided pit lane. So there's either going to be a 25-car pile-up or they're going to be six wide exiting the pits and it's going to be brilliant. So wait and see which way that goes. Did anyone else notice that Andre Holmgartner is on 666 points in the Supercars Championship after a devil of a weekend in Simmons Plains?
Oh, look what he's done.
See what we did there?
That's good.
So not to that.
It's hot,
not,
isn't it?
It could be hot. It'd be very hot. Yes, that's right. Sorry, I got it wrong. Not goes to a few weeks ago when I whipped out my soapbox. Do you remember I had a big whine about the improvements at Phillip Island where they've fixed it all? It's all safe now. We've fixed it. Mm-hmm. So on the weekend, only four different dirty, old, awful earth bank tire walls were hit. One at Eastern Loop, Southern Loop a few times. Over Lukey Heights got hit on driver's right, left and right out of MG. So that was four of them so that they missed in their renovations. So come on, we're better than that. Get your act together, Phillip Island. Don't just do it the bike people. Do something for the car racing people. You're going to fix those dirty, horrible walls. Not goes to Foxtel and KO dropping BN Sports. Yeah, if you don't know what BN Sports is, it's probably why they're dropping it because not enough people watched it, I guess. But they typically ran a lot of tennis, a lot of soccer, but also a fair bit of Eurocentric motorsport over there. You know, they run a lot of the 24-hour races like Nürburgring, Spa and whatnot. A lot of open-wheeler stuff, sports cars, FIA F4. Asian Le Mans series was given a run earlier in the year. And now if you want to watch that stuff, you've got to dolly up another $20 a month to pay for their bespoke service. So, yeah, not great. Bit of a bummer there for motorsport fans on the Foxtel. They're going to lose that from July 1st. Another knot. Archerfield Speedway is closing this weekend after 44 years, which is a bit of a problem because Southeast Queensland, they got 3.9 million people there and no speedways and no real plans to have one. So that is a fairly major issue and a big knot. And not to me, I just haven't been able to weave a mention of Pizza Hut into this week's power rankings. So that's a knot. Oh,
there it is.
Yeah. A couple of knots for me. One is for you, Richard. For a man that loves his cricket as much as you do, I cannot believe that you are over on that side of the world in the country that they'll be playing the Test Championship match between Australia and India next week, and you won't get to see a ball bowled live.
Well, I'm going to the bloody Le Mans 24-hour, mate.
I understand that, but the timing was just how bad.
Well, but why?
They could have gone a day earlier and you might have at least caused the first day.
Yeah, but why am I getting knotted for the ECB's ICC's poor scheduling?
No, just a knot that you're not going.
Oh, then okay. Well, it wasn't necessarily
a knot against you.
Well, I'd throw a knot to Darwin being a week after Le Mans because otherwise I'd stay for the first Ashes test. But, you know.
I remember I once flew to the other side of the planet to go and see a 2020 match at the Oval, which got rained out after one ball. And we missed that one ball because we're at the bar.
Yeah, good.
Hey,
I appreciate what you're saying. Thank you.
No, but it would have been lovely for you to go. My other knot is off the back of your KO and Foxtel, Mark. KO, seriously, need to start listening to people in regards to their comments about their service at the moment. It is diabolical. The amount of times that services, you're watching something and then it either stops or it just drops out and then you have to get back into it. There's so many things wrong with it. And when you ring up KO, and from what I'm seeing from what people are posting and the like, I haven't rung up, but from what I've seen, people are just being told, oh, it's got something to do with your internet. Everyone cannot have internet problems as much as the people who are complaining. There is a massive issue, KO, and I think Foxtel are getting a little bit as well. Fix it up, guys. Otherwise, you're going to lose what is valued support.
I notice somebody's done some research and they figured out that they changed their HD settings on their app and that has buggered things up for a lot of people. Like, it seems to fritz out now. So clearly they've got to get
revert
their act
back
together.
To the previous version.
Yep.
Please do something about it. That's it from me.
Good.
Tim Sheehan was a man, gentlemen, that drove a few times at Le Mans. I think he had about four or five starts, didn't he?
He had a great career, Shebex. And last year we put out a special called Aussies at Le Mans, ingeniously titled, covering off the history of Aussie drivers at Le Mans. So there's only been 40 Australians race in that race, and it's not a lot, but some of the best names in our sport have done it. And for that, I had the good fortune to catch up with Tim to not talk about him being a race director, but to talk about him being the racing car driver and driving for the Scuderia, for Ferrari at the Le Mans 24-hour. And with Ferrari coming back into the sport this year, back to the Le Mans 24-hour for the centenary, we thought it might be cool to replay that interview. So that's coming up next. And then next week, we'll do a full preview of the centenary Le Mans 24-hour. John Hindhoff will be on the show. We'll get some other drivers that we'll drag in from somebody, and we'll preview what's going to be a massive race.
All right, good stuff, guys. Have a great time over there, Krause. Enjoy yourself.
Yeah, it's going to be hard.
Good calling, mate. Mark, we'll catch you soon.
Yeah, I hope Richard has a lovely time. Good on you, mate.
And stick around, folks, as we say goodbye. Stick around for Tim Sheehan to join us right here on The Grid.
You're listening to the latest from around the motorsport world. On The Grid.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for joining me. Really appreciate your time and your insight into your experiences at one of the world's great races. Where did Le Mans first come into your radar? What was the first memory you have of knowing about this incredible race in the middle of France?
Well, my first memory was the front page of the Melbourne newspapers in 1955, when there was that horrendous accident with the Mercedes and all those fatalities. So that would have made me 12 years of age. And I was just sort of getting the bug. I was just into motor racing. And so that was a different sort of introduction to it all.
I can imagine. What sort of impact did that have on a young guy that was looking at this sport and perhaps one day dreaming of racing cars?
Well, Richard, I have to tell you, that was 65 years ago. And to be honest, I don't remember. But it couldn't have been. It couldn't have been too negative, of course, because I went on then. I was passionate about motor racing. And I went on, and I mean, I'm still in pops. I've had an incredible career, incredible life, really.
Mm. So you went to Europe as a young driver to race open wheel cars. Was that where? Was sports car racing first and foremost? Was that on the agenda for you, or was the sole focus making it to Formula One?
The sole focus was making it to Formula One. So my passion was open wheel cars. Sports cars didn't come along until it must have been 1970. I might have done some 2 litre sports car racing, I don't recall, but 1970. I think through the introduction of Jack Brabham, I was invited to, as one of the drivers with Matra team, to drive with Jibui and Depaye. And I'd been racing against them in open wheelers in previous years or at the time. And I think they were a bit suspect to me, and they didn't really want to give me much of a go. And I think I got 2 laps practice or one evening. But as it turned out, all the cars failed, I think, in the first car. All the Matra cars, all the teams were out. Despite having done something like a 28-hour test at Paul Ricard at the time.
Really?
They were all out.
So you never got a lap, because some of the results sheets from 1970 don't list you as one of the drivers where others do. So you didn't actually get to drive in the race itself in 1970.
No, and if I'm right, I think all the cars were out in the first hour. They had some, I think, oil problem. You'd have to look that up to confirm that. But no, I didn't get in the car in the race.
What were the French like to work with?
Pretty distant. Mm. Pretty distant. After that time, I'd only been racing with English teams. So. Yeah, that would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah. And then fast forward 3 years and you find yourself in a Ferrari with Carlos Reutemann. How did the deal come together with Ferrari to end up in that car at that race?
Well, the deal came together the year before, 72, when Ferrari had built that beautiful little 312 PB sports car. And I drove with Ronnie Peterson. We won a couple of races that year, Ferrari just won that, I think it was the World Championship of Makes. I'm not quite sure of the correct title, but it was a walkover. Best cars, best drivers. I have to say best drivers, of course. Best drivers. That was a wonderful year. At the end of the year, Ferrari decided they needed to pay more attention to Formula One. So they ran the following year a much reduced sports car program, but Le Mans was on there. And they were serious. They wanted to do Le Mans. They did a number of tests. They were happy that the cars and the engines would do the 24 hours. So they entered Le Mans. So I was there with Carlos Reutemann.
And you'd had a couple of good results in Formula One by this point, especially in 71 with Brabham, third in Austria, I think, sixth in Germany. So you'd got some points. Did that help you integrate with Ferrari, that they'd seen your performances in F1 and thought, yes, this Aussie guy can clearly drive a racing car?
Well, I'm not quite sure how my name came up, but I was still passionate about doing Formula One. But, you know, you can't turn down a Ferrari factory drive.
What was it like? What was it like driving for Ferrari? There are so many stories from drivers, both back in the day and even today, about what it's like racing in that environment. But can you just give us the feeling of what it was like driving for the Scuderia?
Well, the first thing I have to say, at the time, I don't think, well, I certainly didn't appreciate it, to be honest. I mean, my focus was Formula One. Yes, Ferrari, that was great. And with Ronnie, we were winning races. We were right up there. But interestingly enough, in 72, the first race we did was in Buenos Aires. Ronnie and I won the race, and we must have got maybe a dozen cups between us.
Yeah.
We went back to the tent, to the garage, and to Peter Shetty, and said, "Look, you know, what should we do with these? We can't, you know, there's too many to take home." And he said, "Roger, I'll give you a word of advice. Why don't you give some to Mr. Ferrari? He'd appreciate that. Very seldom does anyone give Mr. Ferrari any cup." So Ronnie and I gave him, we might have given him 3 or 4 cups. And so from that time onwards, whenever we were in the factory, we were always welcomed by Mr. Ferrari in his office to say hello or say ciao, whatever. He didn't speak English. We didn't speak Italian, but we were always welcome. And it was a great group for the team. So everything was wonderful. The following year wasn't so great because Matra came along with a proper sports car, monocoque chassis, a lot of aerodynamic work, which Ferrari were pretty restricted on. So they had a much better car. So the following year wasn't so good, but it wasn't a serious effort at the championship by Ferrari, except for Le Mans. That was going to be important for them.
Mm. You mentioned the Ferrari 312, beautiful looking little car, 3-litre flat 12 engine. So all those wonderful Ferrari characteristics. What was it like to drive and to be part of that machine?
Well, it's a great team. So first of all, and you know, Ferrari or perhaps any Italian team, when they're winning, it's even better still. The 1972 car was short wheelbase, so it was very good on tight corners or medium speed corners. Fast corners a bit nervous. The following year they extended the wheelbase and they did a lot more aerodynamic work with the car, so the car was was easier to drive, for want of a better expression, which you really wanted in sports car racing. You didn't want to be fighting it the whole time and wearing the tires out and open using the brakes up. But it was a tube frame. It wasn't a monocoque chassis, so it wasn't as sophisticated as Matra, as I said.
Mm. So your last, before I move on, Carlos Reutemann, what was he like to drive with?
Well, we got on very well. Very well. We're roughly the same size, same as with Ronnie, so there was no need to have padding in the seat or anything like that. It suited us both quite well. But I should tell you, I have a couple of good stories about with what one had to do with Le Mans and Ferrari. In those days, you had the regular pits opposite the grandstand on the pit straight, but the signalling pits was at the end of Mulsanne Straight. So the race started. We had all, between us, the three, we had three cars, had agreed between ourselves and Peter Shetty what sort of speed we were going to run at. So Nazario and Pace, I think it was, they were going to go flat out to try and draw the mattress out and cause them some mechanical problems. Carlos and I had decided on a much slower speed, and Ix and Redmond even slower again. They had a lot of experience there. And I have to say that when you first go to Le Mans, because you've got, in those days, we had two drivers, you didn't have, you couldn't bed the brakes in with machines at the factory or anything like that. So the first practice sessions are full of setting the car up, bedding brakes, doing all sorts of fuel checks and fuel consumption checks and whatever. So when you start the race, you're still practicing, you still don't know the circuit properly.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the race started, and every time I went past the pit, the team would take the lap time, position or whatever, and then you had an old telephone with a little wind-up handle that rang the signalling pits at the end of Mulsanne Straight, just around the corner. But by the time you arrived there and went around the corner, the team were just sort of stumbling out, the signalers, trying to get the numbers on the board to show you what lap you're on and what position you're on or whatever. So really, neither Carlos or I really didn't have much of an idea where we were running. with the fuel system, they had a reserve tank. So when the engine splattered, you just flicked the switch and then you had enough fuel to get to a lap and a half, whatever it was, to get in the pits. But at night, Goodyear had a blimp and they had a big electronic sign on the side. So as you were cruising down Mulsanne Strait, which of course in those days was straight, none of these little girl chicanes, we had a real straight there. So probably doing 200 miles an hour, 320 kilometers an hour, you could look up, and if the balloon was in the blimp was in the right place, you could see where you were running on the on the electronic sign on the side. Otherwise, you didn't really know until you stopped and changed drivers. But unfortunately, we got to, I think, 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, and the engine broke, and that was it.
Yeah, remarkable year, and an incredible diverse array of cars that were in the mix as well. You mentioned the Matras, but Porsche had a reasonable go there with some competitive 911s, and the 908 was fast, and a bunch of other Ferraris as well. So it was a real melting pot of drivers and teams and manufacturers at that point at Le Mans as well.
But you're certainly right about a melting pot of drivers, because I think some of them got their licenses in a week. Because the standard of driving for some of the slower cars was horrendous.
Mm.
But you learn very quickly, it's a 24-hour race. You just always apply a lot of caution. If you're not sure, you wait for your moment to overtake.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. So the Formula One journey ended in the end of 1974. Was it a conscious decision after that that sports cars was it, or were you still searching for Formula One ambitions and opportunities after that?
No, I think by 74, I said that was my last shot with Ron Turunac on that Trojan Formula One car. And I could see I wasn't going to get back into Formula One. And so I was driving at the time for a German, very wealthy German property developer, Georg Luce, his name was. He had his cars prepared at the factory, at the Porsche Racing division of the factory. He only employed one mechanic. He wasn't really a mechanic. He was a truck driver. So the cars were employed at the factory. So I was driving his cars, which on one hand was pretty cool.
Mm.
But being the factory, of course, they were there wasn't much development going on with the cars. That was the Carrera, 3.2 Carrera, am I got that right, and the 934 and the 935. I was having a fair bit of success in that Deutsche Rennmeisterschaft, the German racing series, with him. And I was at Le Mans with the team as well. And I really only had, I'm just trying to recall now, when we raced the 934, the engine broke on the first lap. So I came and broke just before the pit entry. So I was able to come into the pit lane with the pouring oil all over the pit lane. But 77, which was the last time I did Le Mans, it was the last year I was racing, I was in a 935 with Twan Hazelmans.
Mm.
And we were going, we weren't an outright contender, but I have a feeling that you'd be able to check all of this. We're running sort of fifth in the race, something like that, fifth, sixth in the race. And we were through to Sunday, early Sunday afternoon, and Twan didn't come round. And in those days, the mechanics could, when a little motorbike could go out and try and find the car, which they found the car on the side of the track at on Mulsanne Strait with Twan still there.
Mm.
So, and you weren't allowed to touch the car, as the rules are now. The driver could work on the car, but the mechanics could. But what had happened was the fuel pump, a mechanical fuel pump had seized, lost fuel pressure, and of course the engine stopped. So the mechanics said to Hazelman, just wait there, and they went off. And they got a rubber tooth belt, one of those long French rolls, put the belt in there and went back and indicated to the marshals there that the driver was hungry. So Hazelman understood what was going on, gave him the roll, he went around the back, took the belt off and got underneath and replaced the belt. Unfortunately, the fuel pump had ceased, so the moment he started, the engine it broke again. So it'd be nice to have a happy ending and finish the race, but there was none of that.
Still a remarkable story, though. That's incredible. Yeah. So in 75, you raced with a Kiwi by the name of Howden Ganley, and I'll come to Howden in a minute because your stories would be intertwined for a lot longer than that. 76 with the same driver, with Tone that you were talking about, you finished second. So that was your best result. Second in class, 16th outright. Any recollections from the 76 race in particular? That was in the 934.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I don't recall ever finishing Le Mans.
Really?
Yes, so I've heard a few people talk about that, but I don't recall having finished Le Mans. Now, maybe my memory is still pretty sharp, so I don't know about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, the internet definitely believes that you finished second in class and 16th outright in a Porsche 934 in 1976.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. But to go back to Howden, and obviously in 75, did you meet him before that year, or was that the first time you two had worked together?
No, I met Howden when I was doing Formula 3 in 68, 69. Mm. And our sort of paths crossed through, well, Formula 3, not Formula 2, because he went off and did Formula 5000. And then our paths crossed again in Formula 1.
So where did the decision to form a racing car construction company come out of all that?
Well, that came in by 76. I was sort of finishing my career. I always wanted to do Formula One. I was married, had a son, Guido, and I was looking at what I could do moving forward. What else could I do? And the only business I knew was motorsport. Hmm. So someone had come to me with a proposal to build a Formula Ford car, but have a short production on the Formula Ford cars. I didn't know much about business. Howden knew a little bit more. He had a business overhauling gearboxes, racing gearboxes. So I went to him and said, what do you think of this? So he came back a couple of days later and said, well, this looks pretty good. This is something that looks like it would work. But why don't you and I do it together? So we agreed that, and that was the start. It was 76. We called the car Tiger. We pronounced it Tiger. Probably correctly, you might say Tiger. We called it Tiger. Mm. So the TI from Tim and the GA from Ganley. So we started building those cars. We got on to Formula Ford 2000s, Sports 2000s. We built a Le Mans car. Neil Krang, another Australian, was racing. Formula 3 car, Formula 2 car. We had a race team. And in the end, I think we built about 400 cars between 76 and 82.
It's a remarkable story, Tim, and it probably doesn't have the same level of exposure than other car company or motorsport construction car companies in Australia have had over the years, but remarkably successful. A couple of Australian Drivers' Championships with Alfie Costanzo, yes. But the sports car success as well was enormous across Europe. GB in North America, you were successful as well, but class wins at Le Mans. How hands-on were you from a business ownership point of view when your customers were running their cars at races like the 24-hour?
I never went to the 24-hour race with one of our cars, but as far as the business was concerned, I sort of managed the administration side. Howden, a lot more mechanically, had the mechanical smarts than myself. Had the sort of concept of the cars, the design of the cars, and we had a draftsman who took the concept and put it onto paper. And of course, we attended races where our customers were running cars. So it was a very busy time. And you know, you put a huge amount into building race cars, but you don't actually get out of it what you put into it. Mm. Satisfaction-wise, yes, if you're successful. Financial, no. It's a hard slog.
And was it satisfying to still have that involvement in the sport from a competitive standpoint?
Oh, yes. And I mean, we had some great drivers. We had James Weaver, for example, who carved quite a career in sports car racing. He was driving for us in the early days. So, you know, seeing the cars, seeing your cars win and being part of that is something special.
And the company, I think late 1980s was wound up. What was the decision behind that?
Well, I left the company in 82. I was trying to get back to Australia. Yep. And I was offered a job to run an IMSA team out of San Diego in 82. So we all packed up and moved there, my family. I had two twin daughters by then, Natalie and Laura. And so we moved to San Diego and had a couple of years there. And that team was then going to return to Europe. And I was right in the point of, which, you know, what am I going to do here? I've been writing letters to people in Australia who I kept in contact with, and nothing was happening there. And I'd written to Cairns, as it was at that time, as the name was at that time, and I had a nice letter back saying, no, we don't have anything for you. Mm. So we're right on the cusp of going back to England. I still had a house in England. And I had another letter from probably a telegram or telex from John Keefe, who was the Secretary General at the time, saying that they did have an opportunity, had an opening, and would I fly up and do an interview. So they sent me an air ticket. I flew Los Angeles, Melbourne, did the interview, and I was offered the job. So I went back to San Diego, got all the family, back again to Australia, and started at Cairns. And I have to say that was an eye-opener, because I'd never really worked in a proper administration before. So this was a whole new phase of my life.
And the rest, as they say, is history, because to this day you continue to work for Motorsport Australia. To round out the Le Mans story, what's the overriding memory you've got of that race from your time as a driver? Is there one thing that stands out, or is it, a like we said before, a melting pot of memories and feelings from that time?
Well, to most people, the 24-hour race is a long race. My introduction to Nürburgring was in 1969 in a touring car race on the North and South Circuit, so combined length around 30 kilometres, in an 82-hour race.
Oh, really?
So you could say, I could say Le Mans seemed like a sprint, but of course it wasn't. No, the thing that was, you had to look after the cars. I think today you can probably drive pretty much flat out the whole race, but you had to look after the cars. So that was the first thing. As I said before, the driving standard for some of the slower cars was atrocious. You had to be really on your mark the whole time, but you also had to drive probably 5 seconds a lap off the potential that you could do, the qualifying speed you could do. Mm. And funny enough, that's very hard to do, because it's hard to concentrate running. You'd think 5 seconds is a short period, but in fact, for a race driver, half a second a lap is slow. Mm. 5 seconds is vintage speed. So you had to sort of work out ways in which to drive, use less revs, do things differently, so you could still be alert and concentrate and be that and run just that much off the pace.
Your story in Australian motor racing is a great one, Tim. Thank you so much for your time and giving us some of your memories on the Le Mans 24 Hour. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much, and look forward to seeing you at a racetrack sometime soon.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and I hope your listeners enjoy this little piece.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.